The end times are upon us. Do you need absolution? Me? I don't need forgiveness for much. I always bless people after they sneeze, and I never drink stale, mediocre coffee. Of course, that last one is easy, since they're Sparkplug coffee. Sparkplug starts with premium Arabica beans that have been directly sourced and fairly traded. They offer blends and roasts to suit any taste, including decaf, half-calf, and your next new favorite. But the best part is that Sparkplug delivers this coffee to your home or office within a week of custom roasting it here in Toronto so that it always reaches you fresh and at its peak flavor. And you will taste the difference. And you know I wouldn't lie about that, because lying's a sin. You can order Sparkplug as you need it, or you can sign up for their autopilot set-it-and-forget-it delivery so that you never have to worry about running out. And right now, Sparkplug has a special offer for Top 100 listeners. If you use the promo code TOP100PROJECT at checkout, Sparkplug will give you 10% off your next coffee order. That applies to any size order, and you don't need to be a new customer to take advantage. So what are you waiting for? The second coming? It's time to start making the best coffee you've ever had in your own kitchen. Plug yourself in at sparkplugcoffee.com.
The end times are upon us. Might as well get drunk.
Cheers.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Project.
And action.
Hiya, film zealots, and most holy thank yous for downloading the next 147 project. The ongoing exploration of classic movies. We started this podcast over 6 years ago by reviewing the 123 motion pictures on the AFI's two lists of great films, both the 1998 and 2007 editions. What do when you finish that task? You delve into the thousands of other movies out there, and you spoil them. I'm the skeptic who has a good idea, but not faith, Ryan Ellis, and here's the lady who digs on Crush Groove and likes spending time in fucked up bars, my hetero life mate, Bev.
That's me.
Hetero, I guess, implies over the same sex, but no. I'm stealing a line from the movie.
Homo would be life mate. They're heterosexual and that they're friends because they're heterosexual. Although I call into question Jay's sexuality.
As
just
does
like
the
Rufus
movie.
Does, yeah.
Okay, the coming attractions trivia for this week's picture, Dogma. An important theme in Dogma is that humans can't hear God speak, or he/she would kill them. But Alanis Morissette was supposed to have one line nonetheless. What was it?
I tried to find this and I couldn't.
It's on the IMDb, that's where I saw it. Maybe it was on the commentary, which I would have heard years ago. Plastics. A graduate reference. Didn't I understand that?
Oh no, I understand the reference, but there's just no other graduate anything in this movie. It seems like a tough reference for this audience.
Yeah, I suppose that's true, but then Kevin Smith is a big movie referencer. Maybe he thought, I'll go with a graduate thing, even though he's not really a 1967-era referencer. It's more Star Wars and, I don't know, the mid-70s and upwards, not late 60s and upwards. But no lines are spoken, although Alanis does say, meep, and also an exhale. Those things aren't words, but shouldn't that at least injure the people around there, Bethany in particular? But then Bethany is partly holy. Okay, so no lines, but plastics is what it could have been. Dogma was released by Lionsgate, not Miramax. Miramax had been Kevin Smith's studio with Harvey Weinstein and would be again. What a big story that's become over the years with Weinstein. Anyway, Lionsgate released the film nearly 20 years ago on November 12, 1999. It had a small budget and was by no means a blockbuster, but it's still Smith's biggest hit when adjusted for inflation. It made about $3 million more than Cop Out, which is his second biggest hit adjusted for inflation. But Bev, the movie's 20 years old, or nearly at least, so you better explain it for those who aren't familiar with the Dogma, S-K-I-N-N-Y, skinny.
Linda Fiorentino is Bethany, a cynical abortion clinic counselor who is visited by Alan Rickman's archangel Metatron, who informs her that she's the last scion and the only one who can save the world from a pair of fallen angels played by Ben Affleck and Matt Damon, who are going to use a Catholic doctrine loophole to regain admittance to heaven, therefore proving the fallibility of God and putting an end to all existence. So, they embark on a road trip to stop this from happening and on the way encounter a disciple, a muse, a shit demon, some hockey punks from hell, and, of course, Jay and Silent Bob.
Or, in a nutshell, Jesus' snarky descendant and two sex-obsessed potheads take potential apocalypse rather well. You had issues with Linda Fiorentino's performance, and maybe that's the issue. She seems to no-sell the idea that if they don't succeed, everything's gone.
Yeah, I hate her in this movie. I think she's terrible. There's some problems with the writing, but Her snarky, too cool for school performance is so ill-suited.
It worked in The Last Seduction, which is probably why she got this role. That was 5 years before. It was a star-making performance. She was in Men in Black a couple years before this.
I think she was doing the Men in Black thing, and the difference is she was this sardonic skeptic who took everything in stride in Men in Black, and it works like a charm. I love her in that movie, but translated to Dogma, and it just looks ridiculous. That unflappable sarcasm is absurd. Nothing impresses her or scares her. A flaming pillar turns into an archangel, and you're blasé. You find out you've immaculately conceived a child, and you're like, cool, a baby. No, cool, the Messiah, stupid. But I think the difference is, in Men in Black, she's not the cipher for the audience. Will Smith is the cipher for the audience, and he's impressed by everything he sees. In Dogma, she is the cipher for the audience, and it makes her performance put a damper on the whole film and everything that we're learning with her.
But even as it was playing out, you were criticizing some of the smaller moments, not necessarily the huge ones with God or angels showing up, the climax. You were criticizing some of the smaller moments as if to say, she's not good anyway in this whole movie.
She's so bitchy. I don't even love the word, but I don't know a better way to describe the way she comes across
the
in
famous
this movie.
Story in this movie is that Kevin Smith criticized her. I think on the commentary, he's not all that nice. Well, we talked about it in Clerks years ago, and we covered that movie, that Kevin Smith, one of his both pluses and minuses is that he will dish on Hollywood celebrities. He certainly has ragged on Bruce Willis plenty in those Evening with Kevin Smith specials, and many other people too. But in the commentary, he talks about how he didn't get along with Fiorentino, and he wished he had cast Janine Garofalo, who plays Fiorentino's co-worker at the abortion clinic very early on in the film. Another sardonic, sarcastic person. He obviously wanted that to be the character, if he's thinking that he would have cast someone else who's very well known for that style of acting.
And who's
stand-up
pulled it
comedy.
Off in many other films as well.
And stand-up comedy as well with Garofalo. So that's what he wanted, but it doesn't work that well. I didn't think her performance is quite as bad as you thought it was, but if you thought it was an F, I would have said D, maybe. Mm. But then again, even though I've always said that Jason Mewes, who's not a good actor, but his best role is in Dogma, seeing it again, even though I think it's still his best work, he has so much to do in this movie. He and Silent Bob are probably second and third most important in this movie as far as screen time goes after Bethany. And this is Smith's fault for writing it, but he's sex-obsessed even more than I remembered him being in any other movie or even this movie. It's kind of funny to a degree. Maybe this is the Me Too era or the Time's Up era where he's not quite sexually harassing her, but he's right on the cusp.
Well, there's a scene where they're trapped somewhere. There's all kinds of chaos going on around them, and he starts taking his pants off and insisting that she promised him sex, and it's a situation that, yeah, does not play that well in 2019, but
it does pay off, though, because she said she'd fuck him if the world was going to end, and the world, as far as he knows, is about to end, so that's a good payoff, but it's also, yet again, Jesus Christ, dude.
Is it wrong that I love Jay?
No, you absolutely not. We've talked about him in Clerks. He's better than you ever think he's going to be.
I know.
He's not a natural actor, but in this role, he is natural.
I can't explain it. He's vile. But the film knows he's vile, so we're okay with it.
He's Cartman.
And he has this really harmless vibe. Cartman could actually do harm, but what is Jay ever going to do? Nobody, even a woman who's trapped alone with him while he's taking his pants off, takes anything seriously. She's alone with them, yelling at them, I'm never going to have sex with you, as if they really wanted to do something, she would have a choice. But he's harmless. So none of the characters take him seriously, so why should I take him seriously? I was watching some old clips from Clerks. They just came up on YouTube when I was doing research for Dogma. He has become a way better actor over the years. He is so much better in Dogma than he is in Clerks. Kevin Smith writes him these monologues to do that are ridiculous and filled with swears, and they're so meticulous, and he kills it. I don't know, there's something about him I just find charming. He's really one of a kind.
We talked about in Clerks how he was good in that movie, even though he was a complete non-actor. Most of them were new to acting. By this point, it had been 5 years. He'd been in a few other movies, including some other non-Smith movies, but mostly the Kevin Smith films, Mallrats and Chasing Amy. Smith told this story years ago that he said to Mewes, you can't fuck around like you had in the other movies because you're going to have a lot of screen time, especially towards the end of the film with Alan Rickman, this classically trained actor. Who's Rickman? He's the guy from Die Hard. So apparently Mewes went off and learned the entire script, not his own lines, the entire screenplay, because he said to Smith, give me a line. Gives him one of his own lines. No, any line from the movie. He knew all the lines because he didn't want to piss off that Rickman dude. And I think Alan Rickman's the best thing in this movie. It's one of his best roles. I don't know if he thought this, but one of his most underrated roles. He was in Galaxy Quest this same year, one of our favorite movies, certainly one of my favorite movies. And of course, I just mentioned Die Hard. So those three iconic roles. And Severus Snape, actually, for that matter.
Oh, yeah, of course.
So four iconic roles. And many other films that Rickman made. But I don't think he would have pissed off the Rickman dude, because if he knew the screenplay, then he would have been pulling it off. But Muse was still addicted to heroin.
Oh, yeah.
So I guess he was having problems on set. There was one point where they show Jay and Silent Bob, not with any lines, but it's a cutaway kind of thing, and Muse looks like he's falling asleep, and maybe he was falling asleep because he was hooked on the H. That's incredible, considering we're saying he's quite good in this movie and sells the role quite well. Maybe because he's mostly playing himself. Smith wrote him better than he wrote any other character maybe ever. Him and maybe Randall from the Clerks movies, I guess, the ones he wrote the best of all of these characters. But that's saying something, considering this is maybe the best cast that Smith ever had. Not just Rickman, but Damon and Affleck. Major roles, but not even the main players. And Chris Rock, who's not really a movie actor per se. He's never really succeeded on screen as a film star so much as he has in his stand-up specials and a little bit on TV. But I think Chris Rock's probably the second best thing in this movie. And then Muse is up there, maybe the third best thing in this movie. But there's some other good actors in it, and people who are becoming big stars, like Salma Hayek, who I think is cute, but maybe a little bit miscast. A little maybe too much dialogue for somebody who doesn't really have the best... The accent hurts her, let's face it. Salma Hayek is talented, gorgeous. And I think she's likable, but it's a little bit, as always, hard to understand what she's saying at times.
You haven't even mentioned the two biggest stars in the movie yet. Matt Damon and Ben Affleck.
Well, I glossed over them. And the storyline is about them, of course. Before we get into all these other things, actually, let's cover the numbers. I didn't do that yet. So Rotten Tomatoes numbers, 67% of critics like this film, which is a passing grade, but not by much. 85 fresh, 42 rotten, and the average is about 6.3. So barely getting by, that'd be about a C in school, I guess, wouldn't it? But 85% of audiences, so they liked it quite a lot. And it was 66th, isn't that interesting? Should have been 666. At the 1999 U.S. box office, The Phantom Menace was number one. The Matrix, we covered a few weeks ago, was number five. And by Smith standards, this was certainly a success. His movies don't cost much, and they don't need to make much, because he doesn't really lose money the way that other filmmakers have. I just said a Star Wars movie, well, Solo last year, considering it was a Star Wars movie, was a failure. Smith doesn't have failures on that level. What do you think about this for Smith as an overall picture? Because I don't know if it's necessarily my favorite of his movies. I would say Chasing Amy probably is. I certainly like Clerks an awful lot. But this might be his best and most accomplished movie, and certainly his most ambitious.
My favorite Kevin Smith movie is Mallrats. I know it's not his best movie. It's just my favorite. And like most Kevin Smith films, Dogma is a good, bad movie. Which is to say that it's a bad movie that we like anyway. It's just as stupid as it is smart. And I was really expecting it to have aged poorly, but it hasn't. It's still really watchable and disarming, even though it's tackling such heavy subject matter. I'm not here to argue for its induction into the Library of Congress or anything, but I was surprised how much I enjoyed revisiting it. I've never liked Chasing Amy the way everybody else did. Maybe I could rewatch it again and try to figure out why it is that that movie always bothered me a little bit. So your question was, in his oeuvre, how I feel about how Dogma fits in? I mean, it's strange. It kind of stands out in the Viewisk universe as being such a serious and fantasy film, really, in so many ways. But the tone is there.
He mixes a lot of tones. It may be a little bit all over the place, actually.
Yeah, it's really
And part of the problem is that Fiorentino is playing snarky, but also, in the end at least, is such a believer. Well, and of course, that's what Rufus is telling her not to be, is a believer. It's more about have a good idea.
There's no atheist in this film. Everybody's a believer. It's just the level of whether or not they believe in doctrine.
Smith is
a
Catholic himself.
The movie's just making the argument that God exists, Jesus exists, and he was the Son of God. It's just whether or not all the arcane rules that one church or another makes you follow are correct or even a good idea. You know, a lot of people accuse the film of being blasphemous. But is it blasphemous when you consider that it's one of the few films in the world that takes the proclamations of the Bible as a literal truth and shows characters actively punishing people for breaking the Ten Commandments? It's critical of organized religion, obviously. But it also ascribes power to those rituals. Otherwise, the church's decision to grant clemency to anyone who walks under the arch would be meaningless. I guess there is something offensive about the world being saved by an abortionist euthanizing a comatose patient, which is how the world is saved.
And God happens to be in that comatose patient.
Yeah.
His staff or her staff can never possibly do anything about that, even though they seem to know. Or do they seem to know? Well, they should know. Where God is in that body. Bud Cort, from some Robert Altman movies, and especially from Harold and Maude in the 70s. That's who plays the skee-ball enthusiast. God in disguise, if you will. I like what this movie is trying to say about religious issues. We've covered a religious film ever since we started doing the Next 100 Project. We've done Ten Commandments, we've done Last Temptation of Christ, and we've done Life of Brian. So two comedies and two very serious movies. And the two dramas are, well, maybe not more than Life of Brian, but certainly well-known and probably more regarded, I guess. But the fun thing about Life of Brian and Dogma is they're not shitting on Jesus. Like you just said, this movie pays tremendous respect to the rules, right down to the fact that it's a loophole that Azrael finds, and he is willing, Jason Lee's character, is willing to destroy the entire universe just to end his torment. What a selfish bastard. And Loki doesn't seem to really realize, we talked about Damon Affleck, so back to them, what's going to happen until Bartleby explains it. And, you know, Bartleby bullies him into doing this. Bartleby seems to be willing to do whatever he has to do, no different than Azrael, to get out of his torment in Wisconsin. And we talked about performance issues, but Ben Affleck and Matt Damon, actually more Affleck, I think, in this movie. Affleck, I think you could argue sometimes, was at his best with Kevin Smith. I think in Chasing Amy, and certainly parts of this at the end when Alanis Morissette as God is about to kill him. Thank you. He knows he's going to die. This isn't about being, well, maybe he's going to be forgiven and taken to heaven. That's really debatable. But he knows that his life on the earth, he probably wanted it to be, but it's going to be over with. But it's finally over. So that's why I think he says, thank you. And I think Affleck plays that moment pretty well, right down to him being mad in the movie. Damon's goofy. Unlike Damon, that was going to be the Jason Lee role. And apparently Adam Sandler would have had the Azrael role instead. But Sandler couldn't get out of doing maybe Big Daddy, one of his goofy comedies. So Jason Lee went from being one of the more major players to somebody who's in the movie only a little bit as Azrael. And they were both coming off of Chasing Amy. There's a ton of Chasing Amy actors. Kevin Smith uses his view of Skew Universe actors in this in general with Affleck. And Damon had been in Chasing Amy. He would be in Jay and Silent Bob Strike Back for Smith. That might have been it for him, actually. Affleck was in more than that. Lee has been in more than that. But there's other actors from Chasing Amy. Like the guy who plays, is it Dwight from Chasing Amy? He's got a small role in the strip club. So Smith was using a lot of people he had just used only 2 years before. Damon's having fun, and it's also interesting he played a different Loki only a couple years ago in Thor Ragnarok, also acting as Loki.
Oh yeah, that's him in the beginning of Thor Ragnarok. I totally forgot that. It also brings back Ben Affleck and Matt Damon.
Only 2 years after they'd done Good Will Hunting mm-hmm. together.
Did they ever do another movie together after Dogma?
As actors, I don't think they have. They worked on Project Greenlight, which was a TV documentary series, and of course that made movies, but they aired that on TV as far as I know. I never saw Project Greenlight. I guess they were on camera. I don't even know. They did that for a few years after they got their cachet from making Good Will Hunting, but I don't know that they ever worked together again. You're right.
I don't think so, and this is just a nice meta...
Oh, Jay and Silent Bob Strike Back. They're both in that.
Oh, right. Okay, but only in Kevin Smith movies. But it's like a nice meta... pop culture callback to them as the buddies that they were back mm-hmm. in the 90s, where they were always associated with one another. So of course it works that they would play these two fallen angels. They're the biggest stars in the movie. They're not in the movie that much, even though the plot revolves around them. They don't have nearly as much screen time as the main road trip cast. They probably don't even have as much screen time as Jay and Silent Bob.
What do you think of what I said, though? Rickman and Rock, I think, are one and two as far as best performances in this film.
You keep talking about all these great performances that Kevin Smith has gotten out of people. He's best at directing people to playing themselves, whether it be Jason Mewes. Certainly Ben Affleck, I don't think that was like a real stretch for him. And maybe that's
to
true
play
for
an angel?
Well, but he's playing like a Joe. He's not acting like an angel in the sense that angels are special from humans. They really just act like humans. And the character of that angel is almost a douchebag. Maybe full douchebag.
He's a douchebag.
Yeah. He's got a very bro-y attitude about him, which is Ben Affleck. So maybe that's true with Rickman. And I'm not saying this is what Rickman is really like, but I suspect that Kevin Smith lets his actors do what's ever most comfortable for them, and then Rickman was allowed to do whatever he wanted. Who was Kevin Smith to, like, tell Alan Rickman to give him another take and try it a different way?
They seem to get along, because when Rickman died a few years ago, Smith did a podcast about it, got teary as he often does, and it sounds like they had remained friendly years after they made Dogma. Sometime before Rickman died, maybe not that long before, they got together for dinner. I think when Smith was in London, maybe doing one of those evening with type things he does. And Rickman seems to still hold him in high regard, or at least like him well enough. It was Rickman's idea. I think he's the one that called Smith and said, let's go to dinner.
Say what you want about Kevin Smith, but he seems just like the most fun, lovable guy that would be so fun to hang out with. If you jive with him, then it would be a pleasure being friends with him.
I think one of Rickman's best moments that he ever had on screen, and that's saying something, considering all the movies he made. I don't think he was ever nominated for an Oscar, which is shocking. He's one of those people. Martin Sheen's another one after a long career, never once an Oscar nomination. But anyway, it's a moment that's made me tear up before. It didn't this time. But when he has to tell Bethany that he's the one that told Jesus as a 12-year-old, 13, whatever, you're going to die. This is your mission in life. That one day, all the people that you enlightened are going to kill you. And I never really thought about that before, that someone had to tell, okay, we have to go by the logic that the Bible's real, and we will for the sake of argument here, that someone had to tell Jesus that's what's going to happen to him. He's still just a kid, and he maybe doesn't know what his future is. And because God can't speak to the son, because he would kill him, here's this other guy that has this job, and he said, take it away, make it not real. And then, I've never told anyone this before, but if I could, I would have. I think that's a very powerful moment by Rickman. Really well delivered and well written. One of the best scenes that Kevin Smith ever wrote. And I think maybe Linda Fiorentino's best moment in the movie is when she's in the water. Why me? Maybe that, not so much. But when Rickman and she are talking after that, he's walking on water, and the way that whole thing plays out, I think is one of the best moments in any Kevin Smith movie. And those two actors, I think, really work well together in that moment. She's not snarky, and she's not an asshole in that moment. She's actually just listening to somebody who she should be listening to in the first place.
It's a moment of earnestness, too, because Jesus had to sacrifice something. We talked about this when we covered Last Temptation of Christ last Easter, that if Jesus was cool with his role, if he was placid about dying, then it wouldn't have been a sacrifice. And that was kind of the point, as cruel as it is. It's a point that they brought home, yeah, in a pretty emotional way. One of the rare emotional moments in this movie.
It's set in 1998, and of course the movie was released in 99. Y2K was a fear that was later that year. That's not really something that plays in this movie, but anytime we cover a movie from 1999 that's about any kind of apocalyptic type things,
the end of the world was on our minds.
It was. Yeah. So it probably was on the minds of the filmmakers, because most movies that were released in 99 were probably made a year before, but they knew what was supposed to be coming, and we really didn't know what was going to happen. And the church that George Carlin is the cardinal of is celebrating its centennial, which is why they do the Buddy Christ thing, the Catholicism wow. We have a Buddy Christ on our speaker not far behind me here in this room.
Like an action figure. Mm-hmm. The Catholic rebrand.
The plenary indulgence as well. And the movie is actually almost cross-country, more Midwest to East, because the Angels are in Wisconsin, Bethany is in Illinois, and then we end up in Jersey, although most of the movie was shot in Pittsburgh.
Really?
I think some of it was probably in L.A. as well, Hollywood, but most of the movie, including that church at the end, was in a city that we enjoyed visiting a couple years ago, the Berg. And there's a disclaimer off the top, very much a la Monty Python, so you get your laughs right there, where they go on about platypuses and all that kind of thing. And then a lot of thank yous at the end. Smith has always done that, thanking people. It's a nice touch. I think I mentioned this last week, or I have at some point at least, that Kevin Smith never has a Kevin Smith film with his movies, because it's his idea that the movie is everyone's. Yeah. Yet also the irony is that Kevin Smith is a self-promoter. He obsesses about his weight, and then he bitches when an airline, what was it, Southwest Airlines, made him pay for two seats, or wanted to make him pay for two seats. He talks about his weight for years and years on his podcast and his stand-up specials, and then when somebody calls him on it, which apparently is what they had to do, it wasn't like they just picked him randomly, how dare they? So that's the thing about him. I like him, but he's very frustrating too.
He added those titles to the beginning of the film after people were preemptively protesting it. The Catholic League, I think, was the one that started out decrying the film before, naturally, before anybody had seen it.
Probably never have seen it.
They probably never have seen it. They just heard what the plot was and who made it and jumped all over it, which is their way. A funny thing that he did is they had a protest outside of one of the theaters in New Jersey, and then Kevin Smith and his wife and a friend made some signs and showed up at the protest. I don't know if they tipped the news off or what, but news cameras were there and they interviewed them. I watched it. It's hilarious.
He claimed he was Brian Johnson, who's his friend.
And they ask him, why do you hate this film? And he's like, well, I don't think it stands for anything positive. What do you think it stands for? His answer was, I don't know, but I've been told, not good.
But I like that Clerks movie that he made, though.
Yeah, right. It's really funny. He's giving a very earnest, quote-unquote, performance as a protester. I recommend checking out the old newsreel clip.
Well, I think he's a real guy, but he's also a movie maker, so he's often performing. Smith has always said he's a writer who happens to direct, and I do like his writing better than his direction in general. I think most people do. But even the writing can be pretty arch. We talked about that on Clerks with Chasing Amy, which is, as I said before, my favorite film. But even in some of those great scenes, the fights that Affleck and Joey Lauren Adams have, a lot of scenes in that movie where people are emotional and they're still saying things they probably wouldn't say in reality when they're all worked up like that. There'd be a lot more fucks. There'd be a lot more short words. It wouldn't be this
arch way of speaking. You wouldn't sound nearly that articulate. Yeah.
Yeah. But he's like Tarantino or Mamet, one of those kinds of people who writes not the way people speak. What do you think about the writing in this movie, though? Because for the most part, it's a movie with a plot. He wasn't big on that, much like Scorsese, one of his heroes. Not a lot of plots in his films. I guess Tusk has a plot. Red State has more of a plot than most of his films. They're also more fantastical, all three of those. You probably haven't seen as many of his movies as I have. I've seen everything he's ever made, and most of them more than once. But what do you think of his style that way? Is it pushing you away? This one in particular, where you've got so much bro-y shit, especially with Jay being the way he is and so on.
Well, I guess this way of taking these high-minded ideas and making them digestible so that you never get too deep in the woods. And if you ever do, Jason Mewes pops up and gives the most idiotic, filthy, crass rant about sex or drugs or John Hughes movies. It takes us all down a notch, and then we can just go back to letting the dialogue wash over us without feeling obligated to draw any significant conclusions from it. It never gets that deep. It's possibly the closest approximation to getting high and shooting the shit with your most verbose friend. Even though it's as heavy as it is, the stakes feel really low and you can enjoy it for what it is.
I like when they are talking theology around the campfire.
Yeah.
Deep stuff, too. But like you said, people shooting the shit with each other.
And his writing is such a specific voice. There's really nothing else remotely like Kevin Smith dialogue. And while you could accuse it of being crass and silly and, as you said, arch, you could also have to give him credit for being really fun and entertaining and funny, too. Silly. Who's above being entertained by this? And he's a writer, really, who chooses to expose his audience to his writing through the medium of film, which may be good or bad because he's really not that good of a director. He's no visual style to speak of, unless he's trying to directly homage something specific. His style is point the camera at the action and call it a day. It's almost this DIY style that leaves you to focus on the main event, which is his dialogue.
There are some nice touches, though, including Damon Affleck and Rickman wear hoodies, which are meant to represent the halos they would have. Okay. But also, those three guys are dressed the same, except the colors are different. They have overcoats and they have hoodies and they have the same kind of outfit. Also, Mubi's restaurant, which we see fairly briefly in the midway point of this film, the Golden Calf, which is referenced when Damon and Affleck go to the shareholders meeting. Mubi's was the setting for Clerks, too. It's a big part of the movie where Randall and Dante end up working there as employees. But Mubi's here is both a Golden Calf thing, playing off the Bible stuff, and also the fact that it's just their version of McDonald's, effectively.
It's like a McDonald's-Disney hybrid.
And that whole thing about spitting out the alcohol, where Rickman wants some tequila, but then another glass. You don't know why at first, and then realize, oh, we can't drink it because of what had happened with Loki and Bartleby many years before, many centuries before, I guess, yeah, or even eons before.
God brought in prohibition because some angels got drunk and made damn fools of themselves.
Although Bartleby seems to be drinking beer on the train when he doesn't reveal to Bethany who he is. There's all kinds of bottles sitting on the table between them. Doesn't seem to have spat it back up, and he hasn't revealed who he is, so, a loophole there, but this movie is about loopholes. That's also a kind of a good scene in a way. There's some funny stuff in there with Loki and Jay and Silent Bob. But they all happen to be on the same train. And the fight is kind of bad. Not very well executed at all. But then you do have a nice payoff. The only two lines that Smith has in this whole film, he speaks more in other films. He has a monologue in Clerks. He has a monologue in Chasing Amy, a long one in Chasing Amy, in fact. And he speaks more in Jay and Silent Bob Strike Back. Not a lot in that movie, even though he's in that movie way more than any other film, because they're the main characters by a mile. But he speaks a fair amount in that, especially when he has this whole thing about movie rights towards the end when he's talking to Mark Hamill or Chris Rock or somebody. But in this movie, the only two lines he has are, one of them is in the train scene, "No ticket," which is a reference to Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade when Indy throws a Nazi out of the Zeppelin.
Oh.
And they all wonder why. No ticket. And at the very end, when Rickman, I think it is, says, "If you do clean up your language, I might put in a good word for you with the big boss. Thanks." So only those three words does Smith speak in this whole movie. It's funny, too, because on Clerks, we talked about how he was going to be Randall, but I guess he realized he couldn't direct the movie and also act in it, and maybe he realized he wasn't a good enough actor to pull it off anyway. But that's why Randall's the best character in the first movie, and even the second movie, for that matter.
Like Jason Mewes, Kevin Smith as Silent Bob has this real DIY charm. Doesn't have a lot of lines, but he does act a lot with his face. He reacts a lot. And
almost like a silent film star. He overdoes a little bit, but he needs to because he's not actually speaking on screen.
And it's ironic, of course, because Kevin Smith is the most verbose person in history.
In reality, yeah, never shuts the hell up. One of those evening with, I love that, I think it might be the third one, Muse comes out at one point, everyone goes nuts, and he says, "You've answered one question." I think it was an hour and a half into the special.
You just need one question to get him going. 90 minutes later, he finally wraps it up.
Could be a stand-up comic and or just a storyteller and just do that, or the podcasting.
He is kind of a storyteller. That is his job.
I mean, he could only do that, and he'd still be fine. He could make money doing that and never make movies again. It's funny, we talked on Clerks that he was going to be making Clerks 3. I talked about that many times in that podcast, but it still hasn't come out yet. Maybe they're not going to make it after all. I don't know. But it's not even on his radar anymore.
Other than maybe Jersey Girl, have any of his... Oh, and of course, Cop Out. But after that, other than the View Askew universe, one dud after another lately.
But as I said before, they don't cost much, so nobody really has a big problem with the fact they don't make a ton of money. Maybe that's why Woody Allen has always gotten away with it, too, because A, you get the prestige of having Woody Allen, and there's some prestige in having Kevin Smith a movie of his coming out in the fall or the summer. But also, neither of them cost you much. So they're not putting out $150 million to make your movie that nobody gives a shit about. And that's what's going to end a career a lot sooner than somebody that costs you 25 to 30, and the movie makes no money. One of the things I like the least about the guy, of course, is his obsession with shit jokes and fart jokes and dick jokes. There's a character in Chasing Amy who's saying, "Keep bringing them on, I love them." And I'm not really the biggest fan of them. The fact that he relies on them so much, including the shit demon in this movie. Don't eat lunch when you're watching about the midway point of this film. The shit demon's beaten by an air freshener. It's a pretty good gag. That's just a little squirt and he's down for the count. But it is, I think, his biggest weakness, along with the constant sex talk from Jay, who's trying to compensate for his gayness, I guess, because in this movie it's supposed to be that he's imagining guys when he's jacking off. And the only reason they even meet Serendipity, at least the way they do, is that she's a stripper, and Jay takes Silent Bob in there to prove, I ain't gay.
The scene that I said that I went back and watched on YouTube of Jay and Silent Bob and Clerks, he's talking about sex, and he's just going on as he does in this verbal diarrhea stream of consciousness, and then eventually he starts describing what would happen if he were to go down on Silent Bob. And he even goes as far as to get down on his knees and, like, make the face that he would make if he was sucking Silent Bob's dick. Then he stops himself and has this gay panic freak out. He's like, I never would. I just like pussy or whatever he says. And in that moment, you're kind of led to believe, oh, maybe all of this talk of loving pussy so much and wanting to bang chicks is covering up for the fact that he actually is a latent homosexual. And then it's kind of laid bare. Or at least he is far from a zero on the Kinsey scale. Rufus says outright, you masturbate more than anybody else on this planet. And when you do, you're thinking about guys. And not all the time. But he does seem to genuinely appreciate Serendipity when she's stripping. He does really aggressively try to have sex with Bethany.
He's bisexual.
I think he's bisexual, but he's obviously, clearly attracted to men as well. I think a lot of his talk is just to his latent homosexuality that he's trying to cover up.
Smith has a gay brother, so he can make the argument that he's actually sympathetic to homosexuality, but he's talked about these kinds of things, sex in general, in his movies. Clerks has the 37 blowjobs thing, and other sex references for that matter. Chasing Amy is about a lesbian that gets converted by a straight man.
Who slept around before she met him, and that's a huge issue as well.
And that is human behavior.
Slut-shaming and promiscuity.
And it's human behavior to be having sex or thinking about sex on a regular basis. But then the funny thing is, they talk about sex so much, and as we've said before, with our friends, we don't really almost ever. We're all married, maybe that's part of the reason why. If some of us, at least, were single, maybe we'd be discussing our sex lives. A friend of mine actually come to think of it when he was still single. We didn't talk about the details, but just him dating women and where it would go. So it's not entirely out of the realm of possibility. Plus, we're double the age of Smith's audience, even now. We probably were when we did Clerks, I guess, too, for that matter. God, in this movie, is referenced many times as a man. And the very beginning of the film is in the body of a man, but at the end, ends up being a woman. Now, I guess that's covered up by the fact that Chris Rock says, it's not really anything, man or woman.
Yeah.
But it is clever that when we finally see God as God, we know this is supposed to actually be God now, Alanis Morissette, in a woman's body. And I do love the casting because Emma Thompson apparently had the role. Holly Hunter was even talked about. I think maybe she might have taken the role. I don't even know for sure. But that's why Muse says, what is this, piano? Why isn't this bitch talking? So that would have been a Holly Hunter thing. And Emma Thompson would have been, of course, a better actor. And then you get Thompson and Rickman working together like they would in other films. They were in Sense and Sensibility, at least. And were they also in something else? So they were both in Love Actually, I guess, as well. Maybe not together.
Holly Hunter was in Love Actually?
No, Emma Thompson.
Oh, Emma Thompson.
But Alanis Morissette, I think, is better casting because she's cute. And she's actually adorable in some of the things they have her doing. The handstand where she falls over and you see the boxer shirt she has on. The multiple
under
outfits.
Under her tutu.
Right, and her multiple outfits she has in just about, I don't know, 3 or 4 minutes of screen time. And then meeping the nose. And didn't, like, I tell you she was funny?
That's my favorite part, is him being like, see, she's funny.
The fast cleanup by God were the big mess. And I guess maybe you could argue that the bodies are either taken to heaven or they're just alive again somehow. The reason why that happens is because outside the church in that whole area, they told Smith, you got to clean this up now. Or at least in the next couple of hours. And I guess it was him that came up with the idea, let's just have it that God just Thanos snaps and everything's back to normal. Maybe those people aren't alive, but all that shit is gone. And I think you mentioned this already, but Bethany has an immaculate conception. She bleeds in God's hospital room first, which is an interesting touch because it seems to suggest that she's pregnant then. But then when she's fixed later with the wax on, wax off scene, another good moment by Rickman, by the way, another movie reference, of course, then she's pregnant with the last scion.
Which she should make a way bigger deal about. great, I'm going to be a mom.
She lost her husband, or he ran away, left her, because she couldn't get pregnant.
Yeah, but also, this is an immaculate conception. Who's the child you're carrying? And I think Rickman says to her, she's got a rough road ahead of her, referring to her baby, implying that it's a girl, but also implying that rough road because she's the Messiah. She's the second coming.
How come there's not a dogma too?
I think people asked him if he was going to make a dogma too, but he said, this is a direct quote, "Dogma was the product of 28 years of religious and spiritual meditation, and I kind of shot my wad on the subject."
Plus, he wasn't going to work. He wasn't going to work with Fiorentino again because they really had troubles. I guess Gillian Anderson might have been in line for the role. Around this time, she probably was in line for a lot of roles because of her success on X-Files, and he was a huge fan of the X-Files, Smith was. I don't know, Anderson, Garofalo, Fiorentino. I think going into the movie, I would have thought Fiorentino was pretty good casting. But either her dislike for him and dislike for the movie, I'm not really sure what was going on there. She hasn't made anything since 2009. And I think she's married to somebody, so maybe she's just happy to be working at home. We've talked before that women also get typecast. You're too old, you're not going to get any roles. But usually even the older actresses get roles in something.
Yeah.
But maybe she's behind the scenes, and Smith talked about it enough in this movie that no one wants to work with her, period. It's hard to say. You haven't worked in 10 years. Is that your choice or Hollywood's choice? Going back a little bit into the movie and the plot line, Jason Lee, who I've liked in things, but is a little bit of an arch actor, certainly is arch in this, but he is playing a demon. He gets caught monologuing at one point, and that's probably the biggest scene he has in the whole film. That's also maybe referenced in The Incredibles to this movie because he gets caught monologuing and actually addresses, "Oh, I got caught monologuing," to Mr. Incredible. And that's what happens here, because if he just killed everyone, it wouldn't have mattered. They would have not been able to stop Bartleby and Loki, especially Bartleby at that point, from going through the church and ending all existence. But he gets killed by George Carlin's club. That's good casting, too. George Carlin, who's a noted atheist, but playing a cardinal. And he's got some funny moments. Carlin, I've watched his stand-up specials lately. Not the whole things, but just snippets of them lately. It just comes up on my YouTube, the recommendation kind of thing. And we know he's an atheist, and he has a strong point of view on a lot of things. But he does tend to overdo with his face, even during those stand-up specials. And that's true here, too, but I still love the casting. And it's because he's blessed his clubs that they're able to get out of that mess they're in, which is actually pretty good writing, I think, too.
So I guess Azrael dies, but he has to go back to hell when he dies. Because what he wants is to die a true death. And I think they say something in the film where Bartleby and Loki could kill themselves anytime they want. They just have to cut their wings off and then they would be mortal and just die like humans. But if they died, they would get sent to hell.
Yeah.
I think it's implied God sends Bartleby to, like, nothingness. That's why he's thanking her. And that's what Azrael wants, but I think Azrael winds up back in hell.
One of the things that's nice about this movie, too, is the writing with Bartleby and Loki, that they didn't do anything that was all that bad. It's kind of like Moses hitting the rock the wrong way in the desert, so he doesn't get to go to the promised
land. God is kind of petty.
God's a fickle, petty motherfucker.
Yeah, well,
as written, I'm not making this up, it's in the damn book. At the end, I like the Team Heaven group as well. It's woke before woke was a thing. Two women, one who's Hispanic, a black guy, and an Englishman.
And the black guy insists that Jesus was black.
Which was undoubtedly true in that part of the world.
He was Semitic. Like, he would have been Middle Eastern.
Certainly didn't look like you and me. Wasn't pure white by any means. This whole bullshit with Megyn Kelly and other people. Blue eyes. Blonde and blue eyed was definitely the way it was. Well, first of all, none of us know for sure. Good God. Realistically, the person looked like, when you see that online, you'll see a picture of him looking the way he probably would have, or whoever this person really was. Wouldn't it look like you and me?
Yeah, and God is a woman, and then it's implied that the resurrection of Christ will be a woman. The Messiah that Linda Fiorentino is pregnant with.
If I could flip this table over, I would flip this table over. Another thing the church didn't like, I guess, controversial about this film, is that.
Please, they didn't even get as far as finding out that before they decided that the film was
bad. But they would have hated it, is what I'm saying.
Although the Catholic Church officially didn't have anything to say about it. They just didn't bother getting involved. It was
the Catholic League.
The Catholic League, which is separate from the Vatican.
Alanis Morissette is in Jay and Silent Bob at the end. She closes the book on the view of Skewniverse. It was supposed to be the last movie they ever made. They ended up making Clerks 2, and I think that's all the Jay and Silent Bob have been in since. Although, they probably will be in something before Smith dies. I'm sure they'll do the characters at least one more time. But she appears in that movie after she is actually billed in the credits. I love that touch. God is Alanis Morissette, and she's not been on screen yet. At the very end, she is. Anyway, what did you think of her in this role? Because, wow, that's your God, eh? You talk about man all this time. Although, Salma Hayek, as Serendipity, is often saying, or maybe always saying, she. But everyone else is saying he. Is it actually a lucky break that didn't get the better-known actors?
I don't know. It's hard for me to say, because when the movie came out, Her album, Jagged Little Pill, had been ubiquitous forever. And for our American listeners, there's a thing up here in Canada called CanCon, Canadian Content Law, which means that radio stations have to play 33% of their content from Canadian artists. So when a Canadian artist like Alanis blows up, the radio stations play every single goddamn song from their record ad nauseum until everybody can't stand to hear it anymore. And I was totally at that point with Alanis Morissette when this movie came out. I was really sick of her face. Now, 20 years later, she's not so much unavoidable, so I can appreciate her for what she was, which was very cute and surprising. Maybe he could have done better, although it's hard to say. I will say this, the song that she wrote for the credits is boring and lame and inappropriate for the movie. Completely misses the tone of the film.
I love the song that's in Clerks 2 at the end, though.
Oh, okay, I can't remember.
I downloaded that one, I think, not long after the movie came out, or maybe when I got the movie on DVD a few years later. It plays during the movie, and then, of course, I think it's on the soundtrack. Oh, it's on the soundtrack album for sure. That's how I got it. We haven't mentioned yet Scott Mosier, Smith's producer and partner in so many movies. I think he'd produced all of Smith's flicks at this point. Well, he certainly had, and he did most of them in total. He hasn't worked on them the last couple of times. I did not know he co-directed last year's pretty big hit, The Grinch, that animated film.
Really?
It was him and some other guy that directed that. He's been looking to direct a film for a long time, and that's what he finally did. I guess maybe that takes years, though, of course, if animated film does. But Mosier and he, I don't think, had a falling out. He just wanted to have his own career directing. We talked about that in Clerks. Mosier and Smith went to film school together, and they agreed. Whoever writes the script first will make that movie. Had Mosier been a faster writer, they might have made Mosier's movie, and he might have been the director. And who knows where Smith would be right now. He'd have a career, I guess, if he was the producer and a co-writer and editor. They both edit these movies all the time when they made these flicks. Smith still does. He's edited all of his own movies. I think it was Clerks 2, where he had a rough cut before it was done. Well, not before, I guess, but right after. Maybe even during the wrap party, he was able to show them the rough cut. Which does not happen.
Good Lord.
But he'd work at night. He said he can sleep later. He's only on set for a month or so. These movies get shot pretty fast. Maybe not Dogma so much, but Clerks 2 did not take very long to shoot. I think they went to Pittsburgh again. Anyway, he was editing at night.
Yeah, maybe he should have been shotlisting. And then maybe make a storyboard instead. Maybe think about how to make your film visually more interesting.
That's not his thing.
Oh, there's something to be said for editing as you go, because then you can figure out something that's missing while you're still on set.
The movie is 2-3-5-1. We watched the DVD. It used to be on YouTube for free. Maybe it still is. I haven't looked in a little while. The cinematographer, Robert Yeoman, who mostly works with Wes Anderson, has shot some of those beautiful movies he's made. I think I read somewhere that Smith wasn't impressed with that choice because Lionsgate, or maybe it was actually Harvey Weinstein, because they were going to release this movie, but then because of the controversy, Disney by then owned Miramax. Disney was against it, so then Harvey had to sell it to Lionsgate. But I think it was Harvey that promised them to get this top-notch cinematographer, and Smith wasn't that impressed in the end with Yeoman. That's what I read. Maybe that's not true. But I think he shot the movie just fine for what Smith wanted. It looks okay. And then the composer, Howard Shore, one of the legends, did Lord of the Rings most famously, I guess, but also works with Cronenberg and Scorsese. And there's also a lot of Beethoven music in this movie.
Ode to Joy. Isn't it God singing that while he's
humming it, isn't he?
Yeah, when he's outside the skee-ball place.
I think there's also some other Beethoven songs. So we just talked about the look and the cutting. Well, we didn't really talk about the cutting. It's a fairly long movie. I think it's Smith's longest movie. So what do you think of those technical credits?
I would say that technically it is a completely unimpressive film.
Well, I know that, but what about the cutting?
It's unimpressive. It's standard. There's nothing inspired about it. It's timing. At least he has a good comic timing for the most part, but the story's a hot mess. I could have lost the whole movie thing. It doesn't pay off. It's just kind of there in the middle.
Oh, when Damon Affleck go to the board meeting?
Yeah, yeah, and they slaughter everybody.
That's to get Damon Affleck on screen more, I think.
I guess so, but that scene, it's both needless plot-wise, but really needlessly cruel. We're not ready to stop being on their side at that point.
One of them is the Angel of Death.
I know, but we've been enjoying them at this point in the film. Maybe don't make them hardcore villains like that until you're ready to really kill them at the end. The audience has to turn against them at the last possible moment so that we can just keep enjoying all of their great bon mots until that point.
You know why they get away with it? Is because Bartleby describes all their flaws, and some of them are really bad. So when Loki kills them all, it's easier to take because he's killing terrible people except for the woman who's done nothing wrong. Although she didn't say, God bless you, when I sneezed.
You could slaughter everybody in any room if you stuck to the first four commandments. Because I don't think there's a person on earth who has kept all four of the first commandments, which are, do not take the Lord's name in vain, keep the Sabbath, don't worship any gods before me, and do not create false idols.
Most of us are
God is jealous and petty.
Most of us are probably broken 9 of the 10. Most people haven't killed anyone. But we've all coveted one time or another.
Borne false witness.
You lie every day in somewhere or another.
And it, depending on your definition of adultery, which could include premarital sex, then certainly most people have committed adultery.
Right. So they should be killing everyone they come across. Okay, then last thoughts on our last movie for a while. We're going to take a week off. And our fourth Easter movie in four straight years. Maybe the least of the four, but I think it is pretty fun. Dogma.
Well, you can do a lot worse than spending a couple hours with Kevin Smith's musings on religion. Next time, I might indulge in an edible first.
That might have helped, yeah, it's true. This movie is... maybe not the one they'll remember him for, I guess. If he were to die tomorrow, it would be Clerks. Clerks director. Kevin Smith died in a whatever accident. Well, he almost did die not that long ago, a year or two ago. He's lost all kinds of weight. He still looks so much thinner and healthier than he ever did before. So Clerks would be the one they'll remember him for. But this movie means more. But then again, showing people doing nothing and bullshitting with each other, talking about sex, talking about the things they talk about, is what he does. That's his oeuvre, and there's nothing wrong with sticking to your lane and doing what you're best at. Maybe he got out of his lane a little bit in this movie. But I like the fact that he's mixing tones so much. He doesn't always make it work perfectly. But having people like Chris Rock and even Jason Mewes work off of Alan Rickman, Affleck and Damon, for that matter, who are becoming megastars.
We just talked about Rio Bravo and how it's a great hanging out movie and inspires so much about Quentin Tarantino style. And I think Kevin Smith is really taking advantage of that same part of us, that you can just enjoy hanging out with charming, funny characters like everyone you just listed. It's what makes Smith such a great speaker and podcaster, too. He's really inviting and disarming and smart and funny. So he entertains, but he also keeps you company.
It's funny, though, because Smith's movies are mostly about hanging out, and Hawks' movies, I wouldn't think you could say that about his movies. And yet, between Rio Bravo and Dogma, Dogma's the more ambitious one, the one that's actually on the move, and Rio Bravo's about, eh, let's just hang out in this jail for a couple of days and bide our time and have a little bit of adventures around the town. But otherwise, eh, let's just sit here. Okay, so we are off next week to celebrate Easter, because we're nothing if not holy and spiritual bunny lovers. When you hear us again on April 29th, we'll be going back 70 years to peek at James Cagney in White Heat. I think our first Cagney movie since we covered Yankee Doodle Dandy on the Top Nutter Project.
Yep.
And you haven't seen White Heat, have you?
No.
Okay, I'm going to ruin something for you with this trivia. I think it's a pretty good one, so I had to go this route. So you and everyone else, well, you can't skip ahead, but the listeners can. Maybe about 10 or 15 seconds. The trivia is, and this is a spoiler, Cagney's last line in White Heat was 18th on the Top Nutter quotes. It's, "Made it, Ma! Top of the world!" Often misquoted, incidentally. He says it, then he dies. That's the spoiler. How many other quotes in the top 25 on the quotes list were said and then the character died right afterward?
So how many were last words?
Yeah, effectively. I wanted to make sure it was clear, though, that you die, because last words could be their last line in this movie, and then they're just not in the movie at that point, but they're not dead.
So for the answer to that question, please check out White Heat. But what if you just can't wait until then? You need more Ryan and Bev in your life. Well, you can check out our website, top100project.com. And you can subscribe to the Top 100 Project on Apple Podcasts. We've covered almost 300 movies now, and that includes all 123 movies that made the EFI's 1998 and or 2007 lists of the best American movies ever made. Every episode is available for free, but perhaps in exchange, you could give us a rating and a review. We really appreciate that. It helps people find us. If you'd like to reach Ryan and me, we're both on Twitter. I'm at BevEllisEllis, and Ryan is at MovieFiend51. Or you can reach us by email, top100projectpodcast@gmail.com. And what's more, we would like to thank our sponsor, Sparkplug Coffee. Don't forget that you can enjoy a one-time 10% discount on any coffee purchase if you use the code TOP100PROJECT at checkout. That's all one word, TOP100PROJECT, and it's not case sensitive.
All right, so give me a pound. We're going to go to heaven. Let's ascend. Chris Rock, Alanis Morissette, Alan Rickman, Salma Hayek, you and me all going to heaven together.
Snoochie boochies.
Snooch of the motherfucking nooch.
And cut.
We're not going to heaven. Ever.